And welcome, Hoosier fans, to another episode of Podcast on the Brink, your weekly dose of Indiana University basketball news and discussion. I'm your host, Jared Morris. Podcast on the Brink is a joint production of the Assembly Call and Inside the Hall. For complete coverage of IU basketball, visit assemblycall.com and insidethehall.com.
Hi fans, this is Don Fisher, the radio voice of the Indiana Hoosiers. IU football tickets are on sale now for the 2018 season. Indiana hosts seven home games this fall in newly expanded Memorial Stadium. Don't miss any of the action as the Hoosiers take on the Cardinals of Ball State, the Virginia Cavaliers, and five Big Ten opponents, including Michigan State, Iowa, Penn State, Maryland, and the Purdue Boilermakers. For ticket information, visit IUHoosiers.com today. Go IU!
On this week's edition of Podcast on the Brink, Alex Bozich and I are joined by Rick Bozich from WDRB in Louisville. To complete our off-season trip down memory lane, we've been reflecting on all of Indiana's national championship teams. And this week, we talk about the 1987 national championship team, which in many ways, as Rick explains, was maybe Bob Knight's best coaching job. When you look at the talent that was on that team and kind of the lack of depth. And so we talk about that season, how the season that came before it, the one that was chronicled in Season on the Brink, kind of set the stage for it and then influenced it as that book came out and what impact that had. Why Bob Knight decided to go the JUCO route and bring in players like Keith Smart and Dean Garrett, who made such a big impact on the season. Of course, we reflect on the greatness of Steve Alford and then talk about Indiana's run through the NCAA tournament, including the close shave against LSU, the epic victory over UNLV, and then, of course, the game against Syracuse, which ended with the shot. All of that coming on this week's edition of Podcast on the Brink. First, a quick word from this week's sponsor, SeatGeek. You know, football is back, and SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every game all season long. Whether you're searching for a last-minute deal, planning a night out, or need to find the perfect gift, SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There is nothing quite like being there in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever, and they do that by searching multiple ticket sites and grading every ticket based on a value. And as they do that, SeatGeek helps you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. And that's why I use SeatGeek when I need to buy tickets. I've used it to buy Mavericks tickets here in Dallas. I've used it to buy baseball tickets, to buy concert tickets. They've got everything, and they've got a really convenient app that works great. And that's why I have that on my phone and why I recommend that you do the same thing. And best of all, since you're a listener to Podcast on the Brink, you get $20 off your first purchase. So just download the SeatGeek app, enter the promo code BRINK today. That's B-R-I-N-K. And you will get $20 off of your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. And now, on with our discussion with Rick Bozich about the 1987 National Championship team. And we are joined this week on Podcast on the Brink by Rick Bozich from WDRB in Louisville to continue our trip down memory lane that we have been taking this offseason, talking about Indiana's national championship teams. And this season, Rick, we are going to talk about a team that you know well because you covered this team, the 1987 Indiana Hoosiers. So welcome back to Podcast on the Brink.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking the other day, I was probably 10 feet or less away from the phone that flipped up in the air when Bob Knight pounded the scores table at Cincinnati Riverfront Coliseum when he was angry at a call. And pretty sure it was Gene Corrigan, who was the ACC commissioner at the time, was on the NCAA tournament selection committee, and Knight didn't like a call and pounded the table and the phone flipped up in the air. So I was there.
Well, speaking of angry Bob Knight, you know, the season prior to the championship season is the one that was chronicled in Season on the Brink. And that was insight for a lot of people into kind of what Bob Knight was like, you know, because obviously we didn't know our sports figures quite as well at that time as we do now. And in that season, Indiana went 21-8. They ended up losing to Cleveland State in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But then the Hoosiers were preseason number three going into that 1986-87 season. How did what happened in 1986 kind of set the stage for 1987? Like, is understanding that season an essential part of understanding the story of the 87 team?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, you look at that stretch, and I look back at it getting ready for this thing. I mean, you really go back to 84. That was Alford's freshman season, and he was obviously the signature player in the 87 team. The 84 team had the great triumph over Jordan and Carolina in Atlanta in the Sweet 16, and then lost the game they definitely could have won against Virginia to go to the Final Four. And then the next year, 85 was sort of a, everybody talks about 86, but 85 was a disappointing year. They went to the NIT, and a little bit of his recruiting momentum was starting to sag. And then in 86, a very up and down team that got upset by Kevin Mackey and Mouse McFadden in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And people were starting to wonder, if Indiana was losing some of its mojo. And 87 did represent a turn in some ways, in that, you know, Knight had never been a guy who embraced recruiting junior college players, but he went out and got Dean Garrett and Keith Smart, and they were essential parts of that 86-87 team. And as you mentioned, the book came out, pretty sure it was in early to mid-November. John Feinstein of the Washington Post had been, he's a Duke guy. He was very close to Mike Krzyzewski. Mike Krzyzewski had told Knight that Feinstein was okay, and Feinstein was sort of embedded with the IU team for the 85-86 season. But what some people don't remember is, I think by the time it might have been February or late January or February, Knight got sick of the whole idea of having Feinstein around, and he was no longer, I mean, he was still coming to games, but he wasn't getting the access he used to have, and because he had seen things that I don't think, you know, he was supposed to see. And I think Knight sensed that he wasn't going to have control over this book. And Knight kept blowing up. People would ask him about different things in the book, and instead of just saying, I haven't read it or I don't care about it, he would keep reacting to it, and that just drove more interest in the book. So the beginning of the season was pretty much overshadowed by the release of the book, Season on the Brink.
Now, you mentioned Knight going after the two junior college players, Dean Garrett and Keith Smart. Boy, how about hitting a couple of home runs with your first couple junior college players? We know about, obviously, the shot that Keith Smart hit, and Dean Garrett was a really good two-year player as well. Why was he able to be so successful bringing those two guys in? Because they were such important parts of that 1987 team.
You know, I don't remember which assistant coach deserves credit for that. I think that was Jim Cruz, I think, was one of the guys then. I think Knight, he's a brilliant guy. I mean, he's a smart guy. He realized what they needed and what the holes were in the team, and they obviously needed a big man. They obviously needed a quick guard who could get the ball to Alford and drive some and pass a little bit and play defense, because none of those things were strengths of Steve Alford's, and Smart just fit well with him. Smart, I'm pretty sure, was from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and was a kid who was sort of a late bloomer and overlooked. And as he's proven in the rest of his career, he's become not a great coach, but at least a solid journeyman coach in the NBA, with gotten a slight opportunity that was Sacramento to be a head coach. And I think he's still in the league as an assistant. And Garrett was from San Francisco and sort of also overlooked. And he was, a team oriented guy who defended, and, some of it's luck. I mean, you go for Juker guys, and sometimes they work out and sometimes they don't work out, but they were exactly what Indiana needed at two positions. And it worked out well. And the big thing was that they could take Knight's coaching. That was something that you always have to factor into the equation with Knight, is some guys responded to how demanding he could be, and these guys did, because I think as guys who were not highly ranked in high school and coming from JUCO, they saw going the chance to Indiana, which by then had won two national championships under Knight, as the opportunity of a lifetime.
You mentioned Knight not being willing previously to really recruit junior college players. What do you think was different about this situation? Was it maybe being convinced by one of his assistant coaches that this was a direction they needed to go? Was it him just kind of becoming a little bit more flexible, which kind of sounds ridiculous? Why do you think he was willing to take a chance on Dean Garrett and Keith Smart?
I think he wanted to win. I mean, I think he realized he was having that was the time, I think, where Illinois was starting to get it going with Henson. It's right before, you know, I think Nick Anderson and Kendall Gill and all those guys were going, Marcus Liberty and some of those guys were going into Illinois. So a lot of his recruiting strengths in Illinois had begun to be negated, although he did have Darrell Thomas on the team. And I think that, you know, other avenues that he traditionally found, I don't remember, that's been so long ago, how strong the high school classes were in Indiana, but you know, he just gotten off the Uwe Blopp era and hadn't had after the 81, 80, Whitman and Kitchell, those guys I think left in 83. You know, he just needed to replenish the talent level. And I think at then, another thing is at that time, I think some of his reputation was starting to get out there that he was hard to play for, and players, not everybody thought it was for them. And so I think that, you know, all those things combined, I think he was convinced by one of his assistant coaches that you need to do this. You got one more year of Steve Alford, you need to take advantage of it. You got one more year of Darrell Thomas, you need to take advantage of it. And he did. And it was a wise choice. I think for a long time, he was such a traditionalist that I don't want to say he thought that recruiting junior college guys was beneath him, but I think he believed that, you know, there was a right way to do it, and the right way to do it was with 4-year high school players from the state of Indiana, state of Ohio, and state of Illinois. And that formula worked for a long time, and then life changes and he needed to adjust. And in that case, he did adjust and it paid off.
Yeah, that's another thing. I was just looking at the roster for this team, and you know, we had Kent Sterling on a couple of weeks ago to talk about the 81 team, and the one thing that kind of stood out to me looking at that roster was it was all Indiana and Illinois kids. This is a little bit more spread out from the standpoint of you had guys from pretty much everywhere in the country. Was that more of Knight adjusting to the times, as you mentioned, or was it maybe a less talent available in this part of the country? Obviously, you know, Steve Alford, the star of that team, is an Indiana kid. But, you know, you look at where some of the players on this team were from spread out from around really the globe. You had a guy from Columbia as well. So what maybe in your mind was kind of made the shift for Knight being willing to kind of go outside of the traditional area to get players?
I think part of it, like I said, was I think, you know, some of the kids in Illinois who were really good were looking elsewhere by that time. And I think the state of Indiana was down a little bit. I mean, when Alford came out, James Blackman also came out, but he went to Kentucky. I'm not even sure how much Indiana really wanted James Blackman Sr. Some of those guys did fit the traditional Indiana mold. I mean, it was Alford, obviously. Darrell Thomas was from suburban Chicago, the same high school as Isaiah Thomas, who played for Gene Picator, who's a coach that Knight really, you know, respected. Ricky Callaway was from Cincinnati, which is still in the wheelhouse. Now, Smart, I think, was from Baton Rouge, and Garrett was from California. That team had Todd Meyer, who I think was from Wisconsin. Which, you know, it's still Midwest. And Steve Isle, I think, was from Ohio. Joe Hillman was a kid from California who I think approached Indiana about wanting to play for IU. Palkowski, I think they only took him because he was a big man. They were having a hard time getting big men during that era. So it was probably just a collection of reasons. But, you know, I think looking back on it, even though he later rallied and had those teams with, you know, Cheney and Graham and the two Grahams and that were, you know, Alan Henderson and those guys, Damon Bailey, I think that period there was sort of the first indicator of some of the issues he was going to have in terms of, you know, getting really elite players. If you compare, you know, what, if you look at Mike Krzyzewski as a guy from the Knight family tree, what separated Krzyzewski, I think, as his career developed from Knight is that he evolved as a recruiter and maintained it at a much higher level and didn't have some of the, you know, issues with players leaving that Knight had. And I think we saw some of that stuff starting to show itself in the mid 80s. But I'll say this, I mean, you can talk about the 76 team, which was obviously great. You can talk about the 81 team, which lost more games, but was dominant during the NCAA tournament. But I think in many ways, the 87 team was Knight's finest coaching job because, first of all, it was a five-man team for the most part. I mean, you had five guys average double figures, and I don't think anybody else averaged even 5 points a game. And if you look at those guys, none of them really did anything in the NBA. I mean, the 76 team, all five guys got drafted in the first, well, averaged in the second round, but four guys drafted in the first round. The 81 team, Isaiah Thomas is an NBA Hall of Famer. Ray Talbert played in the league. Landon Turner would have played in the league for a long time. Whitman obviously played for a long time in the league, and Kitchell was a phenomenal shooter. I mean, Alford was no NBA player. Daryl Thomas was no NBA player. Ricky Callaway, no. Garrett, I think, played briefly. Smart might have played briefly, but, you know, if you look at a team like that today, people would say you wouldn't pick that team in today's era to be an NCAA contender because he said, where's the talent?
Hey there, it is time to pay some bills real quick. So some of you will hear a few ads coming up right here. Others of you will go right back into our conversation with Rick Bozich as we continue talking about the 1987 championship team and the great coaching job that Bob Knight did with that group. Here we go. So what was it about the coaching job that he did? What specifically did he do with that team to mold them into a champion despite not having great individual talent?
You know, I mean, he really rode Alford for such a huge part of it. I mean, Alford was a guy who was a phenomenal college high school player for sure, phenomenal college player, and his skill set didn't translate to the NBA, even though Pacer fans threw a fit on draft day in 1987 when the Pacers drafted Reggie Miller instead of Steve Alford because, you know, how was Reggie Miller any better than Steve Alford? Did you watch him play in college? Reggie Miller didn't go anywhere. I mean, Alford was a perfect player for Knight's system. It was a set screens, motion offense, get him open, and he went crazy. I think back to the Final Four when they beat Vegas. I think he had 33 points in that game. Indiana only took four threes. He took all of them and made two. It was the Knight formula, low turnovers, play defense, rebound, be smart, be tough, and win. And that's the way he did it. And the guys that came off the bench didn't score a huge amount of points, but they played, you know, they set screens, they rebounded, and they defended, and that was good enough to win. I mean, I'm pretty sure all five of those guys averaged double figures, so that you don't see that much anymore. It was just it was a different kind of group, and you know, I don't know. They got lucky too. I mean, they shouldn't have beat LSU. I was at that game, and if you want to wait, talk about the NCAA tournament run, we will. And you know, that was a game that they were able to get through. Which, as Knight famously said, I think they're down nine with less than four to go, and assistant coaches thought they were in trouble. But when he looked to the other bench and saw Dale Brown was coaching, he knew they were going to win.
That's a great line.
That was the height of his sarcastic powers back then. But you know, they just won because he was a masterful coach who could get he knew what his talent was. He knew what the limitations of his talent was. He knew the strengths of his talent, and he got the most out of it. And back, I think it's not being exaggerating to say it was his best coaching job, because not only did they win the national championship, you look in the non-conference, I mean, they beat Carolina, and I know they beat Notre Dame, which was still decent then. I think they beat Kentucky. Their only loss, yep, I think in non-conference, was a 4-point loss at Vanderbilt.
Yep.
CM Newton, I think, was the coach down then, and Vanderbilt was actually pretty good. That might have been Will Perdue playing back then, like in 87. Pretty sure it was. Phil Cox and Will Perdue, they had some pretty good players.
Yeah, and I do want to get to the tournament in just a second, but let's talk real quick about the regular season, because, you know, one thing, you kind of look down the schedule, this team is really consistent. You know, I mentioned they were preseason number three. The lowest they ever got was to number eight. They fell to number eight after that loss to Vanderbilt. And you start looking through here, they won close game after close game, you know, beat Michigan by one. They beat Illinois by three. They beat Michigan State by, like, I mean, they just won a ton of close games. But, you know, one thing kind of jumps out is you look at the end of the schedule. They had only lost two games all season prior to late February, and they dropped two in a row to Purdue and Illinois, both games on the road before rebounding to beat Ohio State in the last game of the regular season. Was there any panic at all that set in when they lost those two games toward the end of the season?
Yeah, because there's always panic. You know, you guys follow all your basketball. You lose one game you're not supposed to lose, and there's panic by the hardcore. Then you lose two in a row, then everybody panics. So, yeah, there was panic. I don't remember if that was the game. There was a game at Illinois. That might have been the game where Knight, I think it was, the game before Knight wasn't happy with the way certain guys played, and he might have benched some people at the start of that game. Alford might have been one of them. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I'd have to go back, and that's been, what, 30 years now. But, you know, there's always drama late in the year. And, you know, within any college team, there's no Big Ten tournament back then. So, you know, the NCAA tournament's coming up and you're grinding and trying to win. And, you know, I think there was probably a little frustration. The Illinois game, they only lost by two. So I'm sure it could have gone either way. But, you know, you look down the stretch in that, starting with February 16th, a triple overtime win against Wisconsin, a 2-point win against Minnesota, then they relatively blew out Iowa by nine and lose two games and come back to beat Ohio State at home. So I think, you know, if you looked at that team, even at the time, people that were really savvy about basketball would say it's a really good team, but they were no lock to win the NCAA tournament, even though they were rated high, just because it was basically a five-man team.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think made that particular team so good at winning close games? I mean, I'm looking, Knight made a comment at one point. It sounds like he said, it's paraphrasing, that you know, the this team played the last 5 minutes of big games as well as any team he'd ever coached. Is that consistent kind of with what you saw, and maybe what were some of the reasons from your perspective that this team was so good winning close games?
I got to start with Alford, because he, as a college player, was just phenomenal. And what did he shoot at the line that year? I'm sure it was close to, I can look at it right here. He shot 89% from the line.
Wow.
So that's pretty darn impressive. And he went to the line, let's see, he made 160 out of 180 free throws. You're not going to see something like that. And Daryl Thomas was right there with him. He shot 79% from the line, 136 of 173. So when you got your two best scorers who are really not only getting to the line, they're taking advantage of getting to the line. That's a huge advantage in close games. And both those guys were, you know, fourth year seniors who had played a ton of minutes in a lot of big games. And that was valuable back then. It's hard to relate to now because the game is so freshman and sophomore oriented, but those were seniors and guys who, you know, come up the old fashioned way and done things. And it's, if you're making a, you know, it's always hard to give a guy credit, because when you look at their ability, you say, well, Victor Oladipo is more talented, or Isaiah Thomas or Cody Zeller, but as strictly a college player for all the years, you know, that I was, have covered IU starting since the 75. I mean, Alford, in terms of productivity and what he has achieved, was as good as anybody. I mean, he's just a deadly shooter, and never lost his cool, dealt with all kinds of nonsense from Knight about, you know, his deficiencies, and, you know, got to play on the Olympic team with Jordan and those guys, and that probably helped him toughen up. And that was just Steve Alford's team, and he deserves all the accolades that people sent his way for that team being able to win a championship.
You know, another important storyline for that season is that it was the first year of the three-point line. And when you have a player like Steve Alford, who was such an incredible shooter and shot 53% from downtown that year, how important was that to the story of the 1987 team? And we know, I think Alford hit seven threes in the national championship game. I mean, did they really, obviously they benefited from it because of a guy like Alford, but was that essential in them winning it all, do you think, having the three-point line?
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think Knight really liked the three-point line. And like I said, if you look at the game against Vegas, I think Vegas made 13 threes, and Indiana took four and made two. Knight and Crum, two Hall of Fame coaches in this area, were both slow to adjust to the three-point line. They thought it was not the direction college basketball should go. And at the same year, that was the year Pitino made his first noise on the national level. That's the sole reason Providence got to the Final Four. They upset Alabama, which won the SEC, and Georgetown in the regional here in Louisville, and got to the Final Four. But if you look at Indiana's team stats for that year, they took 256 three-point shots. Steve Alford took 202 of them, and Keith Smart took 33. So that's 235 were taken by two guys. So basically, you have to believe three starters, Callaway being one, and Gerald Thomas did not take a single three-point shot. You have to believe that the way he coached that was to tell those guys, you better not F and take a three-point shot or you'll sit on the bench for 2 weeks. Because think about that. You got three starters who never took one the whole season. So it was a thing where you can shoot one, Steve, because you can make them. And is that right? He shot 53% from three that year.
53%. Yep.
Yeah. And Keith Smart shot 36.4, which is a good number. But, you know, as a team, Indiana shot 50%, almost 51% from three. So it was a very cautious and strategic use of the three-point shot. So, yeah, it helped them, but it helped them in a very rigid way that Bob and I allowed it to help them.
So let's look ahead now to the NCAA tournament run. It was a six-game run. They beat Fairfield. They beat Auburn. Indiana and the
Hoosiers. I'm pretty sure those games were in Indianapolis too, right? Weren't they?
It's not listed here, but I think you're right.
Pretty sure they were.
Yeah, Hoosierdom. Hoosierdom.
Yeah. And so then after that, they played Duke. So beat Knight's protege Mike Krzyzewski 88-82, and then you had the LSU game that you talked about. Before we get to the UNLV and the Syracuse game, which are two games that Indiana fans love to talk about, what else stood out from those Duke and LSU games?
Well, I'll mention Auburn was good back then, and that was not a guaranteed win. Auburn, that was Sonny Smith, had a lot of good players back in there, and they had been to the Elite Eight the year before. They had some talented guys, I think, like Frank Ford and maybe Chris Morris. Duke was a good team. It wasn't a great Duke team. They had their first great team was the year before when they had Johnny Dawkins and Allery and Billison, those guys. They lost four starters. Amaker was back. There was Danny Ferry and I think Quinn Snyder, Billy King. I mean, Coach K wasn't quite rolling back then. And I remember Knight was very uncomfortable going against Coach K. I'm pretty sure it was the first time they'd gone against each other. The game was in Cincinnati. I'm pretty sure on a Friday night in Riverfront Coliseum. And I was at the game. I don't remember all the ebb and flow, but it was 88-82, so relatively high scoring for Knight back then. And I think Indiana was a better, tougher, older team back then and won the game. And up next came LSU. LSU wasn't really a great team. Talented. But I'm pretty sure they lost 14 or 15 games that season. And
yeah, 24 and 15.
They did a good job of guarding Indiana with bigger, more athletic guys. They had a guy by the name of two Wilsons, Nikita Wilson and Anthony Wilson, who were like long, wiry, typical, you know, LSU guys who could, you know, really get up and down the floor and guard. And Indiana was struggling offensively. Knight didn't like the way the refs were calling the game, and Indiana just couldn't get over the hump. And they were behind a good bit of the game. I'm pretty sure they were behind nine at the under four. And then Dale Brown, for some reason, went to a delay game. And he gave the reason later was that his team was a bad free throw shooting team, and he didn't want Indiana to foul them and them to miss a bunch of free throws and lose the game that way. But I think Indiana did foul them and get the bonus anyway, and they missed a bunch of free throws, and IU made plays down the stretch, and they only ended up winning the game by one. It was LSU should have won, but, you know, Knight out-coached Brown down the stretch, and Brown made a big error by the delay game and took some criticism because of it, and didn't react well to it, and Knight already had a big issue with LSU because if you remember back to the 81 Final Four is when he threw the LSU fan in the trash can at the team hotel. There were some LSU fans staying in IU's hotel in Philadelphia. And I think the night before Indiana played LSU in the national semifinals, Knight was in the restaurant or something, and there was a bunch of LSU fans around, and they were doing this tiger bait taunting and thing. And evidently after Indiana beat him on Saturday, some LSU fan popped off to him and he took some fan and put him in a trash can. So he didn't like LSU. He didn't like Dale Brown because I think he thought Dale Brown wasn't a good coach, and he probably wasn't a big fan of the way Dale Brown recruited the year before. LSU had John Williams, who was a big-time player that came there from Crenshaw High School to a lot of questions, and I'm sure Knight liked nothing more than shutting up Dale Brown again.
So Indiana beats LSU. Now we get to the Final Four, and two of the more memorable games in IU basketball history. Of course, you know, the one everybody remembers is that Syracuse game. But you know, you talk to kind of the diehard IU fans and the people who have really been following this for a long time, and they so often bring up that UNLV game as just one of the masterstrokes of Bob Knight coaching and kind of a quintessential example of what made him such a great coach. Can you take us back to that game and kind of what Indiana did that kind of surprised everybody tactically that ended up leading to the victory over UNLV? Because they were ranked number one at the time, I think, right?
Yeah, they were really good. They were very good. That was
Freddie Banks.
It was Armon Gilliam, Freddie Banks. Freddie Banks made 10 three-pointers in that game, 10 out of 19. Looking at Mark Wade was a guard who was sort of their ball-handling dude. I see he had 18 assists in that game. Jarvis Bass Knight. It was sort of a lead-up to his great team a few years later, kind of made legitimize that getting to the Final Four kind of legitimized Tark, and then he was able to get Larry Johnson and Stacey Augmon and Anderson Hunt and Greg Anthony and those guys. In terms of the game itself, I think one thing that was stunning about it was that I think a lot of people thought Indiana would not play at Vegas's pace, but they kind of beat Vegas at Vegas's game. They did go up and down with them. They took advantage of Vegas's defensive issues, and what they shot. Let's see, they shot 62%. I see on 2-point shots, and like I said, they only took 4 threes. Alford took them and made 2 of them. So they beat them with offensive efficiency. Alford had 33. I think 97-93 was the final score. So it was like instead of trying to slow it down and grind it out, I think Knight said, okay, we think you don't guard anybody. And because you don't guard anybody, we're going to punish you. And they did. And it was a shock. I remember sitting there surprised that Indiana went at it as frenetically as they did, and beat Vegas at their game. It was a classic game. It was a great Final Four. If you think back about it, all four of those coaches that were in the Final Four that year, Boeheim, Pitino, Knight, and Tarkanian, are all in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. You mentioned those coaches. I mean, the four coaches that Knight went against on that run, the last four games, Coach K, Dale Brown, Tarkanian and Boeheim. That's a pretty impressive stretch. But you know, I want to ask you about the championship game, because everyone talks about the shot that Keith Smart made, but obviously you don't get to that point of the game without doing a lot of other positive things throughout the 40-minute contest. Any moments other than that or tactical things that Knight did that you kind of remember from that game that stand out?
You know, I thought that Garrett and Daryl Thomas did a tremendous job on Derek Coleman. I mean, people forget how good Derek Coleman was. He was the number one pick in the NBA draft at some point. He got a huge contract. He was certainly a top 5 pick. He was left-handed. He was tough. He could score inside or score outside. And they limited him to 8 points. He had 19 rebounds. They limited him to 8 points. He only had 7 shots. He only got to the line 4 times, and I give credit to Dean Garrett and to Daryl Thomas for shutting off Derek Coleman. Plus, they had Ronnie Cicely. I mean, they had 2 big guys. Cicely hurt a little bit more. He had 18, but you know, they did a good job of taking away the inside at that point. And in terms of offensively, I mean, they had three guys score over 20. Actually, looking at the box score, Alford played all 40 minutes and had 23. And Daryl Thomas was a stud. He had 20 and 7, 8 of 18 from the field. Alford did most of his work in that game. Now that I look at it from three-point line, he only took one two-point shot. He was 7 of 10 from the three-point line. So obviously, just a masterful performance by him. And Indiana won the game, even though it got nothing at all from Ricky Callaway. I saw he didn't score. And I guess that's sort of a clue to what was next for Ricky Callaway, because I don't know how many IU fans remember, but Ricky Callaway played the national championship team and didn't finish his career at IU. He went to Kansas and finished it out. So just a lot of grit from that team. I mean, four guys carried the way. Four guys scored, what, 74 points? They're the only four guys that scored. When was the last time that happened? The team won a national championship with only four guys scoring. So, again, you can only do something like that if you're really well prepared and you know, playing good defense. And they did that. Would have 11 turnovers to Syracuse 14. It was a back and forth game. It could have gone either way. And fortunately, you know, Daryl Thomas sets the screen and he smart makes the shot when everybody was expecting Steve Alford to take it.
Yep. So, you know, as you look back now, you know, Indiana wins a title in 76. They win again in 81. You know, they win again in 87. And certainly Knight had the team there in the early 90s, as you mentioned, in both 92 and 93, that a lot of people thought would win a title. But as we know, 1987 is the last banner that was hung. As you were covering this team after the title, and you've alluded to it a little bit with some of the recruiting issues that had started to crop up, but did you have any inkling that the national championship well was going to run dry after 1987, or was it just kind of assumed at that time that everything would keep rolling on as it had been?
There were some inklings that, you know, there were issues because there were so many players that were leaving. They weren't at the level of Collier and Reed and Recker, which were the three that obviously led to the, you know, the Knight's departure, but that might have been that Mike Giomi and Callaway and a few other guys left, and that was concerning. I mean, that I think that you looked around, and as I mentioned several times, you know, in '89, Michigan and Illinois were in the Final Four, and Michigan had Ramil Robinson and Terry Mills and Glenn Rice, and Illinois had what? It was Kendall Gill, Nick Anderson, Marcus Liberty, Bardo, who wasn't a great player, but he played in it. There was one other one, that Kenny Norman, who transferred in from Illinois State. And, you know, Indiana didn't have as many guys like that. Now, he rallied when he got Cheney and Graham and Greg Graham and Henderson, as I mentioned. And I think that if Allen Henderson wouldn't have gotten hurt, they would have won another national championship in either 92 or 93. I think it's reasonable to say they would have been able to get one of those. There were early signs that sort of Knight's ways were not going to be ways that a certain segment of players didn't want to deal with. They had other places they could go. They had other places they could coach for. And, you know, the culture was starting to change out, and that's also, you know, then early 90s come and the Fab Five, and, you know, he was not a fan of that stuff. And I think that's certainly what helped lead to the last part of his career, where I think, as great of a coach as he was, and I certainly believe he's one of the three greatest coaches of all time in college basketball, that, you know, even he wasn't able to win without players. And as I mentioned earlier, that's the big, he's not the only one that happened to. I mean, you look with Denny Crum at Louisville, where, you know, he won in 81 and 80 and 86 and went to the Final Four in 82 and 83 and then never went back again because he lost his recruiting mojo. I mean, it happens. You always have to adapt and change to the game. And, you know, Coach Crum lost Wade Houston and stuff off his coaching staff and never was able to get the same kind of players he was getting. And for Knight, for a variety of reasons, the same things happened. And that's what has separated him from, you know, Roy Williams or Mike Krzyzewski, is those guys, even as they got into the golden years of their career, were still finding ways to get top players.
In closing, Rick, any other moments, any other kind of little mini stories from that season that stand out that we haven't given you a chance to share as you think back on the 1987 team?
You know, I think the main thing that stood out is, like, everywhere those guys went for a while, I think the season was overshadowed by the book and people asking guys, is it really true that Knight, you know, put sanitary napkins in such and such player's locker? Is it really true that Knight threw Steve Alford out of practice? And, you know, and people trying to figure out which players on the team might have been sources for Feinstein and things like that. That was sort of the number one thing. And the other thing was, I think, sort of people who followed IU basketball just adjusting to the reality that Bob Knight was actually recruiting and utilizing two junior college basketball players, because I'm pretty sure those were the first two he recruited. There were more, Andre Harris, and there were more guys that came later, but if they weren't the first two, they were the second and third. So those were the main things. And then just the whole Steve Alford, Mr. Basketball, grew up in Indiana, married an Indiana girl. I think he got engaged either during that season or at the end of that season by he and Tanya went in the gym. And Alex Wolf did a story about it, I think, at SI, where he was shooting and he stuck the engagement ring up in the nets and had her shag and went up to get the ball, and the engagement ring was up there. So those were the main things. Those are the things that I remember. Back then, you know, Assembly Hall rocked every time Indiana played. I mean, people in those days, for the most part, thought Bob Knight, you know, hung the moon. He was going to be the coach there forever. They were going to win. That was the third of what would be 5, 6, 7 national championships. And nobody at that time, I think, really foresaw that it would be the last national championship they'd have won. And nobody saw some of the turbulence coming that was going to come. I mean, that was, what year was it? 80, it was 88 or 89 when Knight did the interview with Connie Chung, you know, that got him in trouble with some people that he couldn't, no way he could do that now, where he made that comment about rape.
Yep.
And then he got mad because he got criticized by President Ehrlich, and he did the whole flirtation about how he's going to take a job at New Mexico. So there was a big storm coming and nobody saw it. But if you look back at it now, I think you can say, well, you did see some of the signs of it, because recruiting wasn't going as well and Callaway was about to leave and all of those things. So that's what I take back on that. But the point I would make is he did a tremendous job. And if you look back at that season, look back at some of those other teams, say, how did this team win the national championship? I mean, that's not, he probably had at least, I can think of at least three and probably five teams that were better and more talented that didn't win a national championship. 75 for sure, 80 for sure, until Woodson, you know, hurt his back. 92, 93. There's four just off the top of my head. Even 94, the Damon Bailey's last year, that team made it to the Sweet 16 and lost to Boston College. You know, you could argue that they were 84 team that beat Carolina. They were probably as good, if not better, than this team, but they won. And that's a credit to him.
Yep. Well, Rick, thank you for your insight on the 1987 Hoosiers. This has been a fun trip down memory lane, and hopefully we'll have some more championship teams to talk about in the future under the new staff. Time will tell.
Well, thank you for having me. It was good for me to look back and sort of, even I'd forgotten how extraordinary that team was, because, you know, everybody talks about 76 first and foremost, as they should. Everybody talks about 81 because of Isaiah Thomas, but I think this team sometimes is a little bit underappreciated, and it shouldn't be.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you, Rick. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podcast on the Brink. We always appreciate you being here. To get more from me and from Alex, visit assemblycall.com and insidethehall.com for complete coverage of Indiana University basketball. If you liked this episode, please consider sharing it with a friend or family member who loves IU basketball as much as you do. You can also support the show by leaving a rating and review on iTunes, which helps us get the word out to more IU fans like yourself. We will be back next week with a new episode. Until then, as always, go Hoosiers!